On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Neither party's agenda really aligns with who its coalition is today.
It was the dumbest speech I have ever seen in my life of covering politics.
When people walk into a voting booth, at the end of the day, they do say, I really should vote for someone smarter than me.
I'm Warren Altney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
When they entered, fired somewhere between 65 and 75 rounds from their rifles at the scene. We did locate the one pipe bomb. There was actually three pipe bombs combined into one that had a remote control car type remote control device that appears to have not have worked in this case. I can confirm that the suspects were wearing the black style tactical gear that we talked about yesterday. They were not wearing bulletproof vests. What they did have, and what people may have confused, is they had a tactical style vest that held equipment and magazines and ammunition.
That's Jared Burguan, the San Bernardino chief of police, at a press conference this morning. He went on to confirm that 14 people were killed in the attack yesterday. 21 were injured at the Inland Regional Center. He did not have any more information about the victims. At the police standoff with the suspects that took place later in the day yesterday, both suspects were killed and two officers were wounded, but not seriously. The suspects were a married couple, 28-year-old Saeed Farouk and his 27-year-old wife, Tashfeen Malik. Here's what he had to say about the house in Redlands rented by the couple.
I will confirm that the search that took place revealed that there were 12 pipe bomb type devices found in that house or in the garage to that house. There were also hundreds of tools, many of which could be used to construct IEDs or pipe bombs. And in addition to that, they had other material to have produced some additional bombs as well. There were another 2,000 9mm rounds found at that house, over 2,500 223 rounds that were found at that house. And there were additional several hundred 22 long rifle rounds that were found there.
The assistant director of the FBI in Los Angeles, David Bowditch, also spoke at today's press conference.
As you can tell by this investigation and even the media response here today, this is not your average investigation. We have multiple scenes. We have many victims, and it will take time. There are a tremendous number of assets and resources being applied to this investigation.
And here's what Bowditch had to say about the two suspects.
We know there was some international travel. They came into the U.S., both he and his, she was not his wife at the time, but she is now. They both came into the U.S. in July of 2014. They have since had a baby together. He is a U.S. person. We know she is here on a K-1 visa under a Pakistani passport.
And the FBI is investigating whether or not the attack is a case of terrorism. Regardless of where that investigation leads, Muslims in San Bernardino are on edge today. KCRW's Saul Gonzalez visited the Dar al-Ulum al-Islamiyya Mosque in San Bernardino, and he spoke with Nizam Ali, who attended the mosque with Saeed Farouk, the man implicated in the attacks yesterday.
What's going through your head today?
How could he do such a thing? Why would he do such a thing? I mean, his wife is involved, is what we've learned, and he had a 6-month-old baby as well. So it's like, why? How could you do such a thing? Why would you do such a thing?
But others say that, not knowing the man, he's just a man whose image is on a TV screen, you actually knelt next to him in prayer or close to him. That's just a whole other kind of experience.
There are no words to describe the type of shock, the type of surprise that I have and the brothers in the community have. And this was not his local mosque. You know, he was a health inspector, so he was driving. He was working in this area. So when he would, you know, have his lunch break, he would come and do his prayer here at noontime. So that's what I would, you know, run into him.
What do you think is going to be said today during afternoon prayers or tomorrow? What do you think the conversation should be about here?
Condemning. This is a very good question. And my answer is that condemning the act, that we are Americans. We are Muslims, yet yes, we are also Americans. We are all in it together. It's not us versus them. We are a country. We are united by you know, this nation. And we also mourn with the families of that have lost their loved ones.
Final question. Mm-hmm. You are dressed mm-hmm. pretty traditionally. Yeah. You self-identify through mm-hmm. your garb as a Muslim.
Absolutely. This is how I go to school. This is how I present myself, being born and raised here.
Do you walk the streets of San Bernardino with a little bit more nervousness
Absolutely.
Or fear?
Absolutely, because the fear is that now there might be backlashes, there might be resentment from groups that because of ignorance, they might come back and say that all the Muslims are the same or something like that. So that's the fear that I hope that no one comes in with a gun and starts shooting. As you've heard, we had a message that was left and threatening us. Yeah. And it's all because of ignorance. We have nothing to do with it. As I said, we mourn with the families. You know, we ask God to make it easy for them, to give them patience, and to get us through this, you know, storm, if you will.
That's Nizam Ali speaking with KCRW's Saul Gonzalez in San Bernardino. Well, Saul joins us now from San Bernardino. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, so you spoke with other people outside that mosque. What else did they tell you?
Well, it's just such an amazing scene because I drove up on it. I didn't know this was the man's mosque until I started talking to these guys and said, yeah, we know him. And oh, yeah, we know him. And what they said to a man was, and they were all men in front, was, this is the poster child of an ordinary Muslim man in America. This is a man who was kind of creating his American dream, his California dream. He had just had a child. They said, he would come to the mosque regularly. That mosque in particular, because it was on his route. I mean, as an environmental inspector, so it was easy for him to get to. But in no way, they said absolutely, there was no sign of that would cause them to be alarmed. There was no sign of militancy. This is not a man who would take people in a corner and try to recruit them into something. They were just shocked by it. But the shock, as you heard in the man's statement, is quickly turning to some anxiety, some fear. What does this mean for the Muslim American community of the country and of Southern California?
Yeah. Well, so what are they fearful of? A backlash?
They're fearful of a backlash. They're fearful of threatening calls being turned into threatening acts. And they were actually, you know, they're talking to me like, you know, we're going to watch our doors during prayers today. We're going to try to have, you know, usually everybody's inside. So the exterior is completely exposed. There's nobody, you know, in the parking lot looking. They say, well, keep somebody outside. Keep a look on the road. We'll maybe post somebody here in the evening. We'll call the sheriff department to have somebody here regularly or at least to drive by more. So that's the kind of talk that you're hearing at that mosque. And I'm sure, by extension, many others in the region.
Right. And there are about 6% of the county residents are Muslim, which is three times higher than the overall rate in the United States. So a fairly large population of Muslims in San Bernardino County. Why?
Well, I think one big reason, like, it's affordable. I mean, this is a place, you're a new immigrant to this country. You're trying to make it, you're trying to hustle and, you know, find an apartment, and you can find a place to rent that's a lot cheaper than L.A. or Costa Mesa or San Diego, so you come here. You're trying to open up a little store, a halal shop or a clothing store, whatever, you come here. Rents are inexpensive. So, and that's not just Muslim immigrants, that's all kinds of immigrants. And, you know, you drive through the streets of San Bernardino, it's such an interesting combination of sort of mid-century, 20th century America, you know, old signs for stores and fast food joints of the 1950s and 60s, and right next to it, you know, the Latino taco shop or the halal shop. And what a juxtaposition of an older, more traditional community that's been here and newer folks who've arrived.
Yeah, and San Bernardino has had a rough go of it in recent years. It has declined from that pillar of middle-class Americana you just described.
Yeah, I mean, this used to be, you know, still a lot of railroads that come through San Bernardino. There's all many railroad shops here. But this used to be, you know, a thriving, very healthy community. You know, it still is to many degrees. It's become a logistical hub in more recent years. But, you know, it is also a place that's one of the poorest communities in the country of its size. As you said earlier, it's a place where a lot of people are on public assistance. A lot of people work for the government and not for the private sphere here. It declared bankruptcy in 2012. So while it's wrestling with this bloody incident that no community wants, it's also been wrestling with these other things for many, many years now.
All right. I want to bring in the man who was mayor during that time when the city declared bankruptcy. Pat Morris, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much, Madeline.
Well, first, what are you hearing from your friends and neighbors today about what happened yesterday?
Well, deep despondency, great concern and grief, a lot of prayerful concern for the families and the friends and the co-workers of those who were assailed in the regional center. Just a tremendous amount of concern. Churches are having prayer vigils this evening and this week. So a community ripped asunder by this disastrous mass killing.
Yeah. And this is a community that, as Saul mentioned, had not been doing well for a number of years. I wonder if you could describe it from your perspective, what you see in San Bernardino and how its fortunes have declined.
Well, actually, Saul described it, profiled it fairly well in his description. This has always been, it's the oldest city east of Los Angeles. It's an old city, a working-class city, founded largely around the Santa Fe Railroad in the late 1800s. At one point in time in the early 20s, half of the employees in the city were employed by Santa Fe Railroad. With the coming of the great Kaiser Steel plant in Fontana, most of those workers came from our city. When they opened up Norton Air Force Base in World War II, those were workers that came from our city. Those were three major industries, all blue-collar in nature by way of employees, hardworking people who found themselves kind of abandoned by these industries over the course of about 15 years in the late 80s to late 90s. All of those industries closed out. Santa Fe transferred their major operations from our city back to Kansas City and Chicago. Kaiser Steel, because of environmental concerns, closed its doors entirely. Norton, during the Base Closure Act in 94, closed, and the loss there was about 15,000 employees. So major loss of economic vibrancy during that period. And as Saul has described, the result of that has been a mixed bag.
Mm-hmm.
We have inherited a set of housing assets that were old to begin with, and they were acquired largely after the exodus of all of these hardworking families by absentee landlords, who in some cases milked those properties in ways that were not good for our economy or not good for our landscape, and brought in people who were people on the margin. And that has become part of our story.
Yeah.
We're a city in great transition. Not to say we're not in recovery, because I believe we are. We're a city that's on the road back.
Well, you did declare bankruptcy in
2012.
Right. Yeah. And that meant that the fire department was dissolved in favor of you contract out services to outside agencies.
No, we don't. Not yet. We still have a fire department, but
okay.
Part of the exit plan for bankruptcy is to contract out all of our refuse and trash services to private contractors, to contract out our fire services to the county, to basically reduce the economic impact of having major public employees under the PERS retirement system, which mm-hmm. is remarkably expensive for any city. But for our city, it's particularly challenging.
And has that affected public safety at all?
Well, Every department in our city has suffered cutbacks. We've tried to protect the city council and mayor then and now, try to protect as best we're able the public safety unit, not as a police department. And so we kept those numbers as robust as possible. And you saw yesterday the effectiveness of a great department, a police chief and a department well-trained that arrived on the scene within moments of the disaster. And within hours, we're able to take down the assailants on the streets, track them down, and take them down. So that they were well-functioning, something to be very proud of. We've got a good police department that did its job in this case with great talent and determination.
Now, when you were mayor, you made gun violence a priority, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the gun violence in your city that had been escalating even before yesterday's attack.
Right. Well, in the early part of the century, in the early 2000s, our homicide rate escalated dramatically, largely as a result of gangs and drugs. And that was a major issue when I ran for office in 2005. I had just finished 30 years as a jurist and worked in treatment courts, helping ramp up the drug court, mental health court systems in our state and nation. And I brought forward a platform of intervention and prevention, as well as suppression, as a strategy for reducing violent crimes. And it worked. Operation Phoenix was an 18-point vibrant program that dealt not only with I sponsored an initiative for a quarter-cent sales tax increase to hire 40 new police officers. Mm-hmm. That was successful. And then we used resources to intervene in the lives of those who would be drug users and gang members and bring them back into more wholesome and responsible lifestyles.
Are there a lot of guns floating around in San Bernardino? A lot of
there are a lot of guns floating around America. We've got 300 million guns in a nation of 350 million people. I mean, our nation is awash in guns, and our city is no different. It is no different than other urban centers in America. There are guns everywhere. That's a tragedy that, as the president has said, we must begin to address.
Yeah,
and we have not done so.
We are going to talk about that in the next segment of this program. I just wanted to ask you one last question. There's, as Saul mentioned, been a large immigrant influx, Latinos as well as Muslims. And I'm wondering if you're concerned about relations and any reprisals against Muslims in your city.
I'm not concerned. We are a marvelously diverse community. Saul described it well. We are probably one of the most diverse communities in Southern California. For the reasons he described, a lot of immigrant families from all over the world, from Central and South America, from Mexico, from the Far East, and from the Middle East. So, and we have communities within communities, and we have Buddhist temples, and we have Muslim mosques, we have Jewish synagogues, and we have a vibrant set of wonderful churches. And those people work together, always have. And I heard the comments of one of your earlier interviewees who talked about a fearfulness on the part of those who are members of our Muslim community. I don't think that should be a concern at all. There has been no indication, as far as I can tell, of a backlash toward that remarkably important faith base.
Okay, well.
So I'm confident that this community can deal fairly and generously with all who come to us. Thus far, and we will do it in the future.
All right.
It's a great community in that regard.
Thank you very much for joining us today.
You bet.
Pat Morris, mayor of San Bernardino from 2006.
No, former mayor.
You were mayor, yes.
Thank you.
From 2006 to 2014. And Saul Gonzalez, reporter here at KCRW. Thank you, Saul.
Thank you.
All right. We want to know if you're from San Bernardino, we'd love to hear from you. Do you live there now? What should we know about your city? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the program, President Obama says gun violence is a political choice. He and other Democrats are calling for more gun control. We'll speak to someone who favors gun rights about what he thinks the solution to America's mass shooting epidemic should be. That's next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Statistics show that on average, there's a mass shooting more than once a day in the United States. And after awful events like that in San Bernardino, we tend to hear the same political refrains. For example, here's President Obama this morning.
We see the prevalence of these kinds of mass shootings in this country. And I think so many Americans sometimes feel as if there's nothing we can do about it. As the investigation moves forward, it's going to be important for all of us, including our legislatures, to see what we can do to make sure that when individuals decide that they want to do somebody harm, we're making it a little harder for them to do it. Because right now it's just too easy.
All right. What about the other side? There are millions of responsible gun owners in America, and we wondered, what is the pro-gun solution to gun violence? Here to discuss is Dave Workman, Communications Director for the Second Amendment Foundation, a gun rights group. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me, Madeline.
Well, it's my pleasure. Now, we know that when the gun control conversation surfaces, gun purchases also rise. Why is that?
Well, I think that you're talking about an issue that is just toxic with a lot of people. It's going to polarize almost immediately the pro and the anti-gun sides of the debate. It's very difficult sometimes to find a reasonable middle in this conversation. So I think immediately everybody goes to their own corner, and then they start putting on the boxing gloves. It's just kind of a tradition, and it's a real hot subject. You're talking about a civil right here that's protected by the federal and state constitutions. So
Okay. So the Second Amendment, right? But that's a militia question, and I'm just wondering, when you have on average a gun death 92 every day in America, as we heard earlier, some 300 million guns in this country, is there something that from your side can be done to reduce these deaths, and to keep the guns out of the hands of people who would commit mass shootings like the one we saw yesterday?
Well, California, as you know, has some of the strongest gun laws in the United States, and those gun laws did not prevent what happened yesterday. The authorities have not been entirely conclusive about what kind of guns were used. I don't know all the details about the specific firearms, whether they were supposed to have been illegal under existing California state law, or maybe they were legal.
Well, the police said that they were legally purchased.
Well, they were legally purchased, but we don't know where or when. And there are some new gun laws down in California that may have been made some of these guns illegal. Certainly, the magazine size—that's a question. Mm-hmm. But I think to cut right to the heart of this thing, it doesn't appear to me and a lot of other people that the California gun laws lived up to their expectations. They didn't prevent this thing. Remember last year down at Santa Barbara, where that kid stabbed three people to death and then shot three people to death and wounded several others. He went through three different background checks, three different waiting periods. He used magazines that were legal under California state law, and yet he did commit these acts of mayhem. So I think maybe it's time to take a different tack and look at these gun laws and say, geez, are these really effective? Or maybe we ought to roll some of these back, get rid of them, try something else.
Right. Or you could argue, as the other side argues, that they're not strong enough, that we need federal gun laws that are as strong as California's gun laws to prevent guns from coming in from out of state.
Well, we already have federal gun laws that don't allow people to buy across state lines, certainly handguns. You can buy rifles and shotguns, but you still have to go through background check to do that sort of thing. And in California, you've got a universal background check requirement. Here again, I'm not too sure that demanding stronger gun laws to prevent the kind of crimes that haven't been prevented by the laws we already have on the books that we're supposed to prevent this sort of thing is really the solution.
So what do you think is the solution?
Well, first and foremost, we have to remember that most of these mass shootings, if not all of them, have been committed by people who didn't really have criminal records. That allowed them to go out and legally purchase firearms, which is that's the way the law is supposed to work. The solution, I think, has to cut across several levels. They're talking about prohibiting people on a no-fly list, for example, from buying guns. That's only because you're suspected of something. You haven't been convicted of a crime. You haven't even been charged with a crime. And I was listening to somebody, a civil rights attorney, this morning talking about that.
You mean,
I
think because Paul, if you're on a terrorist watch list, you can still buy a gun.
Yeah. Even Paul Ryan said something about that during an interview today, I think with CBS.
But I'm still waiting to hear what your solution is to these mass shootings, and one or more a day on average in the United States. It doesn't happen anywhere else in the world. We do have more guns than anywhere else in the world per capita. So what is the solution? If it isn't guns, what is it?
Well, certainty of prosecution is one thing, but being able to fight back is another thing. I think that there is ample reason to believe that if people had the means and the ability to fight back, which means they should be armed, that's one possibility. And there's a sheriff up in northern New York, in Ulster County, who's actually suggested that today.
Yeah, wait, are you saying that the people who were in that facility yesterday, those workers, if they had had guns on them at that time, at that holiday party, they could have prevented this massacre?
Well, we'll never know that for sure. What I'm suggesting is that if there had been a person or two people in that room who may have been able to fight back, that is a change in the scenario to what we did have. Something like 30 people shot, 14 of them are dead.
Mm-hmm.
And there have been instances when an armed response from a private citizen or an off-duty police officer has put a stop to a mass shooting or an attempted mass shooting. We know that from Trolley Square in Salt Lake City. We know that from Clackamas Mall up in the Portland area. So we have to give that an honest look. And then I think we have to be willing to crack down on people if we take them alive. Most of these guys commit suicide. But we have to bring the full force of law against these people, which would mean the death penalty.
All right. We'll have to leave it there. Dave Workman, Communications Director at the Second Amendment Foundation, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
All right. Do you own a gun? What do you think can be done to prevent mass shootings like the one in San Bernardino while also maintaining your Second Amendment rights? Gun owners, let us hear from you on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, we'll take a break from the grim San Bernardino news and delve into the world of documentaries.
What I think is really fantastic about, you know, some of the films that are coming out now is they may be about a historical event, but they have incredible contemporary relevance.
Why we're in the golden age of documentaries after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It is a big week for documentaries. The Academy announced their shortlist of 15 films on Tuesday, and the International Documentary Association will announce the winner of their Best Feature Awards at a big ceremony this weekend. And the nominees include...
The Black Panthers.
Black Panther.
The Black Panther Party.
Black Panther.
The noise is called the woodpecker.
Amy, just give us a smile and then we can turn the camera off.
Do you promise?
I think the only way to tell you who I am these days is to sing a song. We'll start from the beginning.
Everybody feels like they're a failure. Everybody feels they could have been a contender.
Looking over the list of nominated films, you realize that documentaries have come a long way.
Steel, the nation builder, plays the leading role in the development of America.
You could argue that this is the golden age of the documentary. There are more than ever, they're better than ever, and some of them even make money, lots of money. We wanted to find out why and what's in store for the future and what we should check out right now. And so I'm joined now by Simon Kilmurry. He was executive producer of POV, the long-running PBS showcase of documentaries. And this summer, he moved here from New York to head the International Documentary Association. Hi there.
Good afternoon.
Well, thanks for being here. And do you agree with that assessment that we are now in the golden age of the documentary?
I've been working in the documentary field for close to 20 years, and I agree with you. I think it's an incredible shift in how documentaries are viewed and being made and the audiences that they reach. I think about 15 years ago, documentaries were somewhat on the margins and being watched and consumed by the kind of cultural elites, perhaps. But now they're being seen in theaters, they're on Netflix, they're much more accessible, and also the form itself is just expanded creatively.
So what accounts for that change, this sort of democratization of the documentary?
I think there's a number of things. One is a much easier access to the tools of making these films. There are also a greater number of outlets for these films. And I think there's been a bit of a cultural shift that documentaries are no longer seen as the broccoli of filmmaking, and they're much more, they can be as entertaining as any other film.
Do you think the rise of documentaries, this golden age, had anything to do with reality television?
Some people will talk about there being some shared roots. If you, there was a wonderful series back on public television in the 70s, I believe it was called An American Family.
Yeah.
Which some people call a docu-soap or a documentary series, and some people call the beginning of reality television.
Over a period of 7 months, director Craig Gilbert and his crew shot more than 300 hours of film covering the most mundane and the most dramatic events in the lives of the Loud family of Santa Barbara. The Louds have been praised for their courage and openness, but much more widely blamed for their publicity-seeking and, more profoundly, their failure as a family.
I think there are some shared roots. And I think there's some wonderful and fun shows in the reality space. But I think they're pretty different forms of entertainment, though.
But has it perhaps widened this field to Americans, to spectators who perhaps wouldn't have seen documentaries before, but, oh, well, you know, or kind of are watching reality television and think, oh, well, maybe this is for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think to the extent that's opened up their curiosity to storytelling, I think there's probably some commonalities there.
And has it helped for the filmmakers themselves in terms of getting funding or getting acceptance at all?
For the filmmakers, it's often a way that they actually pay the bills because they're not going to make a huge amount of money through the documentaries, most of them.
Is it easier these days for filmmakers to make money?
I don't think it's ever been particularly easy. And it may be that these days there are more sources. There are more foundations interested in funding documentary because they also see that the topics that filmmakers are tackling align with the mission of a foundation.
When you think of the old guard of documentary filmmaking, you think of the Maisels brothers, you think of Frederick Wiseman, D.A. Pennebaker, and others like that. And they seem to have made much different films than the ones we see normally when we're seeing documentaries now. These films are, I don't know, they're more discursive, I guess, more maybe rambling, but sort of more in the mode of discovery than following a thesis and wanting to prove a thesis. So do you see that kind of filmmaking? I mean, you know, do you see much of that legacy nowadays?
I still think there's a lot of great verite films being made. In fact, Frederick Wiseman's new film in Jackson Heights is one of the best films I've seen in a long time. I saw the Toronto Film Festival, and it's 3 hours long, and it's just an absolute delight. And it may seem like it's not going nowhere, but I think it's these films are made in the editing, and I think what Frederick's done with that film is incredible.
I have always said that Jackson Heights is the most diverse community in the whole world, literally. We have 167 different languages spoken here. We are very, very proud of that diversity. Let's salute that, and let's all be proud of what we have accomplished.
And where is this?
It's in Jackson Heights, which is in Queens, New York.
Yeah.
It becomes this portrait in diversity, a portrait in community. which I think ultimately becomes quite political in its embracing of that. But you're right. I think there's a lot of different approaches to documentary storytelling. One of the big films of the year was Amy, Asif Kapadia's portrait of Amy Winehouse, which is almost entirely archival.
The thing is, I don't think I'm going to be at all famous.
And has no verite pieces except from what comes through in the archive. Or Stanley Nelson's film Black Panthers, which is a whole new light on the evolution, the impact of the Black Panther movement.
Being black in America meant that you didn't walk down the street with the same sense of safety and the sense of privilege as a white person.
Which I think has incredible contemporary parallels and has a lot to tell us and teach us about what's happening today with the whole Black Lives Matter movement, the gun debate, you know. So it's what I think is really fantastic about, you know, some of the films that are coming out now is they may be about a historical event, but they have incredible contemporary relevance.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Simon Kilmurry, the executive director of the International Documentary Association, which supports the work of documentary filmmakers. Their awards celebrating documentarians and their work is this Saturday. So what is the future of documentaries? Is it these big, long, theatrically released documentaries? Is it shorter documentaries that you would see on YouTube?
I think it's all of that. I don't think the feature documentary is going to go away. I think there's a space for and a need often to take time to delve into a story, as there is in a novel. The Look of Silence, Joshua Oppenheimer's follow-up to The Act of Killing, could not be done in a 15-minute film. You need the space and time to breathe with the subject to experience it. At the same time, you have fantastic new venues, New York Times Op Docs, The Guardian's doing short documentaries, Field of Vision, Laura Poitras' new initiative is doing a lot of great short docs. I think that's a wonderful and exciting new space. And in some ways, because we are no longer just tied to broadcast as an outlet, that we have digital outlets, you're no longer stuck with a form with a particular that has to fit a time format. We have interesting work that's being done in virtual reality. The New York Times is doing some interesting stuff there. In my previous role at POV, we were playing in that space too, doing digital documentaries. I think that's a form which is still nascent and still finding its voice. But I think it's an exciting space.
Is there a danger of overload, documentary overload, just too many of them out there?
It's funny, people have said that about what's the kind of the great television renaissance over the past couple of years.
Yeah.
Is just too much to watch with all these great series. You can get to saturation at some point. I think we're a long ways from that. That said, I probably watch many, many, many more documentaries than most people, but I find it incredibly exciting.
Since you watch so many, are there themes that you've noticed recently in terms of subject matter or the craft of the filmmaking?
I think we're at the beginning of seeing a lot of films coming through that are talking about the environment, of talking about climate change. They're also trying to be tools of activism, of trying to get people to do something about these issues. I think that's something where the documentary forum has expanded a lot over the years, over the past few years in particular, is documentaries as tools for social engagement. And filmmakers wanting their audiences to do something after they've watched the film.
So out of the documentaries that are out right now, can you recommend one or two that we should go run out and see?
Yeah, Laurie Anderson's film, Heart of a Dog, which is absolutely beautiful.
And what is that about?
It's about her dog who died.
Oh.
And it's a love letter. But it's really not about that. It's about loss and love and healing and memory.
This is my dream body, the one I used to walk around in my dreams. In this dream, I'm in a hospital bed. The doctor is holding a small pink bundle. and wrapped in the bundle, I see the little face of my dog, a small rat terrier named Lola Belle. I kissed her on the head, and I said, I'll love you forever.
It's a beautiful essay. It's not a straightforward narrative story arc. It's an essay, and it's an incredibly incredibly beautiful film. There's a wonderful Israeli film that just came out in the theaters last week called Censored Voices, which looks back. It's actually based on writings and interviews done by Amos Oz after the 67 war in Israel, which is an incredible historical document. There's, you know, five films coming out in the theaters every week at the moment, and docs, which was never the case 15 years ago, maybe one a month.
So this is a great time for you.
Yeah.
And for your business, for your...
Yeah, for the field in general. I think it's a fantastic time.
Well, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
That's Simon Kilmurry, Executive Director of the International Documentary Association. Tig Notaro will host their annual awards this Saturday night at Paramount Studios in Hollywood. And Warren Olney is here now to talk about what's coming up at 1 o'clock, I imagine, a lot on San Bernardino.
Well, that's right. Actually, that's what our whole show will be about, and we'll go deeper into the incident itself. And then try to put it in context in terms of the kinds of investigations that are going on to determine who might, in fact, engage in a terrorist attack. That is not to say that this was a terrorist attack. The FBI is being very, very careful about not calling it that. And, of course, they have a very specific definition of what they mean, although we do apparently, NPR is reporting that the FBI counterterrorism agents are, in fact, beginning to study the case. We'll learn more about the two people who were involved and just as I say, more about what's being done to try to prevent this from happening in the future.
All right. More on that at 1 o'clock. Thank you, Warren. And coming up on this program, Shenny Jardin is here, our web maven, and she'll talk about how social media responded to the San Bernardino shootings. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Joining me in the studio, Shenny Jardin, co-editor of BoingBoing.net, to talk about net stuff and web stuff.
Hey,
I guess
Madeline.
It's the same thing. Hi.
It's all the same thing.
It's all the same. Well, let's start. We're going to talk about San Bernardino in a minute, but let's start with Yahoo, because this is a little head scratching. The board, I think, today is considering whether or not to sell its web business.
Yahoo's been a hot mess for a while, man. I'm old enough to remember when Yahoo was the go-to search engine that we would use to find websites. Who even talks about
when
websites
we said
anymore?
The World Wide Web?
Yeah, and weblogs. But Yahoo is like your permanently failing relative that just keeps sort of tumbling into not being able to get its act together for like 2 decades. And you just wonder, how are they still breathing?
Well, how do you exist without a web business if you're Yahoo?
Right.
A web business?
Yeah, you know, it began as primarily a web business. And you know, I've watched the company throughout the years. They tried to become an internet video powerhouse. They tried to become sort of the next CNN on the internet and hired lots of news people for a while. And then it was sort of this social crowdsourcing information. There's just been all these strategies, each of which seems to step all over the strategy that preceded it. Marissa Mayer, the former Google executive, took the job, the least wanted job in America, which is to try to turn around Yahoo. And it doesn't look like she's succeeded. It looks like she may be doing a really good job at triage and setting the company up for a possible sale of its assets.
Wow. Well, I hate to say it, but any business with an exclamation point in it, you have to kind of wonder about their longevity.
I'm sorry, but my hot take on Yahoo at this point is just replace it with a question mark or a period. We may be able to stick a fork in it soon. I do not know if it is yet done.
All right, let's talk about Tor. Mm-hmm. Now, this is something that is associated with the dark web, correct?
Tor is a privacy project, a long-running privacy project that originally began with funding by the Department of Defense. And the Tor browser, or as nerds like to call it, the onion skin browser, it's a free tool that you can download to make your internet activity secret. If I hopped a plane to China tomorrow, I might be able to access sites that are banned, sites that are filtered by using Tor, because you access one server and then another and then another and then another. It's all sort of randomized, and it's harder for the existing censorship or spying methodologies to track what you're doing. Tor is asking for money. Tor was the subject of a highly sophisticated, highly targeted attack earlier this year that they're blaming on a specific academic institution in the United States. And they're saying that this academic institution was essentially paid off by the feds to crack this vulnerability and uncloak the identities of Tor users, which do include people who are doing illegal things, mm-hmm. but also include a lot of people who just value their privacy or maybe have security concerns.
So is this public fundraising also a bid to improve their public image?
It should be. Tor has long had the same kind of problem that a lot of really well-intentioned but very nerdy projects do. The people who are great at building privacy tools, the people who are great at engineering these kind of magical things that allow us to experience the internet in new ways, they're often really bad at communicating the value of what they're doing, or frankly, of even making the tool usable to non-super nerds.
Okay, let's move on to the terrible news, the tragedy in San Bernardino. You were all over social media, monitoring it, posting as well.
Like everybody.
Like everyone was.
You
exactly.
know, it was weird. Like even Cosmopolitan and Esquire were running live blogs on this yesterday.
Really?
Yeah, like all these organizations that you don't think of as breaking news organizations. But the thing is, we each of us go to wherever we go to now, the sites or the social media accounts that we like. So it's perfectly normal for me to think that people who come to Boing Boing for our cat GIFs and Bluetooth sex toy reviews would also come to us for breaking news about something that might be a massive terrorist attack. Snapchat was a big player in how we processed what was happening in San Bernardino yesterday, because there were a lot of young people with Snapchat installed on their phones who were running around in San Bernardino trying to figure out what the bleep was going on.
That's really interesting, because
they had great footage.
Snapchat is trying to position itself as a news source.
Yeah, and I can't be cynical about that anymore. Look, the news is where the news is, and if the best, the most accurate, the most quickly available eyewitness footage is available on Snapchat for disasters, acts of God, violent acts like this, then listen, it's where I'm going to look next time.
Well, it's interesting in such a fluid situation, a fast-moving situation as what was happening yesterday, that Snapchat actually would be the most appropriate, you think, because it does, you read it and disappears.
Yeah.
Moves on to the next thing.
Yeah, and as much as I hate, like, geez, you know, the blood isn't even dry. It's a day after, and here we are sort of having our media hot take about it. Look, I think it is. It's fascinating, and it's like a little future shock. How is it that, you know, I grew up in a world where there's three news channels, and there was a very limited number of anchors who all sort of looked and talked the exact same way, and they were very serious. And now, the news really is distributed. We've gone way beyond the CNNI report.
Do you think that's a good thing in general? I mean,
I do.
From a news perspective, a journalist perspective, I always like more information. But I also feel like in these situations, it can be overwhelming and just too much. And I don't know, how much is too much in terms of what is valuable information?
Man, I don't know. Look, I think it's wonderful that the information is out there, that it's freely available. And I do trust random guy with an iPhone on the street across from where the cops were surrounding that SUV more than I trust television news. I really do. The fact that there are so many people just like you and me with the devices that capture and transmit reality as it unfolds, I think that's a wonderful thing for the human race. On the other hand, I think that we as news people, but we, everybody listening to this broadcast, all of us who are online, we need to learn internet self-care. We need to learn that keeping cable news on all day when there's round-the-clock, wall-to-wall coverage of violence and terror and fear, that has real mental health effects. And so does sitting in front of a web browser and listening to the police scanner for 5 hours on a channel that wouldn't have been available
because it
before.
Is unmediated. And I guess the numbing comes from the mediated effect. But when you're hearing it unedited, raw, real, in real time, it's something
if it doesn't
else.
Affect you, there's something wrong with you.
Yeah.
And so I know that for myself, the job that I have in the world and my responsibility to myself doesn't require me to be exposed to that without limit. And to those of you whose jobs do, man, my hat's off to you. And to all those voices that I heard on the scanner yesterday, like the dispatchers and the cops just trying to keep focused and holding it together, I just, the sound of their voice inspires so much respect in me to hold it together in that much chaos with that many question marks.
Shani Jardin, co-editor of BoingBoing.net, thank you.
Thank you, Madeline.
Julie Myers joins me now with the listener feedback.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. So we talked about the gun factor when it comes to mass shootings and shootings in general in America. We had a gun advocate on the show who advocated for arming more people, and that could possibly, in his opinion, help prevent these kind of things. Our listeners, they turned that down. They said no. They said no. Maria Elena Huff owns a gun, and she lives out in the Inland Empire, and she is pro-gun rights, but she thinks it's absolutely absurd to assume that people can just take their guns to a Christmas party and prevent a mass shooting. We had a lot of people that echoed that. We have Gregory Bart, who says, yeah, just imagine if 40 people in that room had been armed, there'd be a whole lot more dead people there. And Javier Robles took a much more sarcastic tack. He says, thank you so much for having that enlightening gentleman on the show. I feel so stupid. We could have prevented this if we'd just grabbed our Uzis before going to our Christmas parties.
All right. Thank you for that. And thanks for your comments. Keep them coming. Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Also Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Julie Myers, thank you.
Yeah.
Your mic's not on, but I know you're saying thank you. And Warren Olney is up next in a few seconds from now. So keep it right here. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.